It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Earlier this month, NASA launched a first-of-its-kind space mission aboard a SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket. The destination? A potato-shaped, metal-rich asteroid, the 16th ever discovered, called Psyche. Here's a listen to some coverage from the launch on CBS, which featured the network's space consultant, Bill Harwood, cutting to NASA's feed.
Give us a sense of how this mission is supposed to unfold. Like, the rocket is going to fly around the asteroid, is going to crash into it. What's the plan? Oh, there it goes.
Well, let's come back to that in just a minute.
On a mission to a metal asteroid in deep space to study the building blocks of our planet's inner space.
Vehicle's pitching downrange.
M1D chamber pressure is nominal.
View there from the onboard camera on the booster. Beautiful shot there as it goes through the clouds.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch the launch of this mission? Are you following it? What questions do you have about why NASA wants to study a metal asteroid? Have you given much thought to the center of our planet or the interiors of other planets? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Sabina Stanley is an Earth and Planetary Sciences professor at Johns Hopkins University and author of the forthcoming book, What's Hidden Inside Planets? That's out on November 14th, available for pre-order now. Sabina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Very happy to be here.
So, first off, why does NASA want to go and study this asteroid?
Yeah, great question. This is a really unique opportunity because what we're really interested in is what happens in the deep interior of our planet Earth. But it's actually really hard to get to the center of Earth. It turns out to be easier, actually, to go out to the asteroid belt and examine this metal-rich world, which is really very similar to the core of our planet. So by going out there, we're journeying to the center of the Earth, and we're going to be able to learn about the center of Earth by going to this asteroid far away.
And I understand that scientists think that this may have been part of what's called a planetesimal before it ended up in the asteroid belt. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So a lot of the asteroids in the asteroid belt are sort of what's left over after planet formation finished, right? So we started with really small pebbles. Those grew bigger. Eventually, you got to meter-sized bodies and these planetesimals. And so if we can go to the asteroid belt and see these asteroids, we're really seeing the ingredients that went into making Earth and the other planets in the solar system.
And how do we know what we already know about this asteroid Psyche?
So there are ways to get data from from other bodies in the solar system. There's been a series of telescopic observations of Psyche up until now, and that's how we've learned about it.
And I understand that this is going to take some time, this journey by the Psyche probe. What is its journey like? How long is it going to take? Could you talk about the route for it to get there?
Yeah, great question. So nothing in planetary science is fast. And in order to get from Earth, where we launched, out to the asteroid belt, we can't go directly because that takes a lot of fuel. So we're actually going to be using the assistance of some of our neighboring planets to kind of give us gravitational assists to get out there. So there will be a gravitational assist. It's going to get Psyche out, get the mission Psyche out to the asteroid Psyche in July of 2029, and then it's going to orbit there for 2 years.
And what will it be doing as it orbits this asteroid?
Yeah, great question. It's going to be taking a bunch of observations and data. The mission has cameras that can take pictures of the surface. It has something called the spectrometer, which tells you a lot about the composition of the surface. And then it has my favorite instrument, a magnetometer, which is used to measure magnetic fields of the planet. And it also has a radio instrument, which, although it's really there to help us communicate with the mission, it also can measure gravity fields in Psyche. So by using this combination of magnetic fields, gravity fields, compositional information, we're going to be able to learn a lot about the interior of the body.
And you mentioned your favorite tool was the one that measured magnetic fields. Is that going to help us determine what kind of metals are in this asteroid?
Yeah, great question. It's not so much determining what kind of metals, it's more trying to understand the question, did this asteroid in its past have a dynamo? So Earth's magnetic field, the thing that surrounds us and protects us from a lot of the harmful solar wind particles, it's created in our core by something called the dynamo process, where churning fluids in the core, churning liquid metals, generate magnetic fields, and we can observe them or measure them here at the surface. So we want to know if Psyche had a magnetic field sometime in its past. And if it did, then the metals on the surface, then the rocks on the surface will actually probably maintain that magnetic field. So we're going to try and measure it and see if there are magnetic fields frozen into the surface rocks that would tell us that it had a dynamo in its past.
We're talking with Sabina Stanley right now, Earth and Planetary Sciences Professor at Johns Hopkins, about a new NASA mission, the Psyche mission, going to a metallic asteroid in the asteroid belt to hopefully learn more about the Earth's core and other planetary cores. We're also taking your questions and comments about planetary exploration and geology at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Sabina, as someone who researches planets so intimately like you do, what are you most excited or hopeful to learn from this mission?
So there's an interesting story behind this mission and Psyche. Some of our original or initial measurements or data from the planet suggested that it was really almost all metal. But more recent data suggests that, no, there might actually be some rocky part to it, too, some of the same sort of stuff that makes up the surface of Earth. So I'm really interested that when we get there and we look up close, is it all the metal at the center and then it's got some sort of shell of rock in it? Is there lots of metal at the surface? Are we going to see iron volcanoes, metal craters, things like this? I'm really excited to get close up and get some of those early measurements.
And you're also a participating scientist for NASA's Mars InSight mission. How does your work on that project inform what you're looking for on this Psyche project?
Yeah, they're actually quite similar in terms of the philosophy behind the missions. The InSight mission was the first mission to Mars that was there to study the inside of Mars rather than kind of rove over the surface and learn about the surface. And so the InSight mission was a lander, landed on the surface of Mars, and it used tools such as a seismometer to measure Mars quakes and figure out from the Mars quakes, which are these waves that travel through Mars, what the interior structure of Mars is like. So it's again about learning about the interior of the body. And so Psyche has a similar philosophy in that we're going to learn about the interior of Psyche.
And before we move on, I just want to kind of a gee whiz note about this mission is that the probe is fueled by xenon gas and solar electric. And it sounds like that's kind of a novel thing.
Yes, I believe it's the first time that this has flown.
Wow, very cool. We are talking with Sabina Stanley, a planetary sciences professor at Johns Hopkins University, also author of the forthcoming book, What's Hidden Inside Planets. We're talking about the new NASA mission to study a metal-filled asteroid called Psyche, and we're going to talk more coming up about the interiors of planets themselves, why they're so interesting, why they're important. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about this new mission, about Mars, the interiors of planets? She studied a lot of it. What are you curious about when it comes to planetary formation and space? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about NASA's new mission to study a metal-containing asteroid in our solar system and what planets are made of and how we're learning more about it. Our guest is Sabina Stanley, Earth and Planetary Sciences Professor at Johns Hopkins University and author of the forthcoming book, What's Hidden Inside Planets. And Sabina, I want to ask, what got you interested in studying the planets and specifically what's inside them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love the challenge of it because you're trying to figure out what's going on in a place that you really can't access, right? It's like you've been given this really beautifully wrapped present that you can't open, and you want to try all sorts of ways to learn about what is inside the box, right? You shake it, you weigh it, you do all these things. But then another aspect of it is suddenly imagine that the reason that the box is so beautiful on the outside is because of what's inside. Then you really want to know what's going on inside. And that's true for planets too. Many of the things that make Earth the wonderful paradise it can be on the surface here for human life is because of the processes going on in the interior.
Could you talk a bit more about that? What is it that's going on perhaps inside Earth that allows it to be a habitable planet?
Sure. First of all, I'm going to go to magnetic fields, which are my favorite thing. The core of the Earth generates a dynamo, which creates a magnetic shield that surrounds the planet. And this stops really harmful solar radiation and cosmic rays from getting too close to the surface of the Earth, where it would have lots of interfering effects as radiation does. So that's one example. Another one, volcanoes, although they can be incredibly destructive, also end up bringing lots of volatiles, gases to the surface of the Earth. So our atmosphere has essentially been outgassed from the center of the planet out to where we can now breathe it. A third example is just heat as well, right? Nowadays, we are really interested in developing energy sources that are friendly to the planet. So for example, geothermal energy is coming from the heat within the Earth. And so it's important to learn about what causes all those things that make it so comfortable here on the surface of the Earth.
We're talking with Sabina Stanley, Earth and Planetary Sciences Professor at Johns Hopkins University. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. Neil is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Neil.
Hi. I was wondering if there's any kind of way they could mine that asteroid to avoid tearing up the Earth.
Gotcha, Neil. Thanks for the call. Sabina, I don't think that's the goal of this mission, but are these mineable resources that are on these asteroids, stuff that would be familiar to us on Earth?
So there are resources on asteroids. There are resources essentially on every planetary body. And there are some companies out there that are interested in looking at whether or not it would be profitable to mine it. You can imagine that it costs a lot of money to even mine things on Earth. Imagine now having to send a rocket and all that instrumentation out to space to go get stuff and then bring it back. So there are definitely companies out there interested in it. It's not happening at the moment.
And earlier you mentioned you compared investigating the inside of a planet to shaking a gift box and trying to figure out what's in there. Some of the ways we do that are, well, one, this mission to this asteroid. You also mentioned the Mars waves that study the inside of that planet's makeup. Are there other ways that we can go about learning what's inside these planets?
Yeah, there's a few things I'll mention. One of my other favorite ways to study the inside of a planet is through its gravity field. So I know in our regular lives, we think of gravity as being this fixed thing. And if you're doing a math homework problem, you might give it a value like 9.8 meters per second squared. But really, the gravity that you feel on Earth changes with every step you take around the planet. Now, it's a very tiny change in the gravity, but that gravity change is coming from differences in the mass of the Earth right below you. So when we go to a planet with an instrument that can measure gravity, we can actually learn about how the material inside the planet is distributed and what is where. And are there things like convection or like plumes of material coming up from the inside? So gravity is one great way to learn about it. Another interesting way is to actually take materials that we're used to here on the surface of the Earth, things like water, helium, rocks, and ask what happens to them when they get under really high pressure and temperature, because the interiors of planets are extreme places. And so you can do experiments where you can take water and you can use giant lasers and really interesting experiments, diamond experiments, to crush things and really squish them a lot and see what new materials you get out of that. And that's another way that we learn about what's going on deep inside planets.
We got an email from Jeff in La Crosse who asks, he says, I understand Psyche might be the core of a planet. He asks, what happened to the rest of the planet? How large might it have been? Was it an original part of our solar system? What do we know about that?
Yeah, the short answer is we don't know. What we do have are other examples to look at. So I'll give you probably the one that people are most familiar with. Mercury, the innermost planet in our solar system, has a really large core and a really thin rocky mantle on it. And that's really hard to make a planet like that from scratch, let's say. So what people think happened at Mercury is that another relatively large-sized body had a glancing impact with the proto-Mercury, whatever it was before, and essentially sheared off or ripped off all of that outer rocky layer, leaving a lot of core on the inside. And we think a similar sort of process might have happened with Psyche. So again, another asteroid-sized body coming by and having a collision with it and shearing off the material surrounding it. Now, where did that material go? Great question. We actually get material like this all the time on the surface of the Earth in the form of meteorites. So many of the meteorites we have on the surface of the Earth were from asteroids out in the asteroid belt that got hit and perturbed and crushed into pieces and eventually came and made their way to the surface of the Earth. So who knows? Perhaps we have, unknowingly, we have some remnant of that rocky outer part of Psyche here on Earth.
And Sabina, if there was a, I know you're working on Mars right now, if there was one planet maybe besides Mars that you could really just get inside of and figure out everything about the core, whether it's in our solar system or elsewhere, what would it be?
Yeah, so I have a soft spot in my heart for the two ice giants in our solar system, Uranus and Neptune. These are fascinating bodies. They're mostly made of water. And when you take water and you crush it under really high pressures, it just becomes a really different beast. We think in the deep interior of Uranus and Neptune, in addition to the water, there are things like carbon-based elements and so forth. We think there might be diamond icebergs floating on a sea of diamond. We think there might be superionic water, which is a new phase of water that you don't experience here on the surface of the Earth. Diamond rain. These are things that I think are absolutely fascinating. So I would love to see a new mission going out to Uranus and Neptune.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty cool. One last question I have for you. Those gas giants, do they have any kind of rocky core, or are they, you know, gas all the way through?
The answer to that is kind of. So rocky, not like we're used to here, not like a surface that you could stand on, right? Because when you take even rocky type materials and you put them under the extreme pressures and temperatures that would be happening inside Uranus and Neptune or even Jupiter and Saturn, the rocks aren't the same thing. They're molten. They might even be plasma. They might have been ripped apart from their regular elemental structure and their molecular structure. So they can be very different. So I don't think it's easy to think of them as like a rocky Earth that's just surrounded with a bunch of gas on top of it. The fundamental nature of that interior part just completely changes.
Well, Sabina, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing all this with us.
Thanks so much. This has been great.
Sabina Stanley is Earth and Planetary Sciences Professor at Johns Hopkins University. She's author of the forthcoming book, What's Hidden Inside Planets? That comes out on November 14th and is currently available for pre-order online. We talked with her about planetary cores, as well as NASA's Psyche mission that launched this month to study a metal-containing asteroid, which could answer some big questions about the makeup of planets. Girls' interest in computing peaks in middle school, according to a study from the group Girls Who Code. But if they participate in computing classes and other programs at that age, they're more likely to continue in the field. Margaret Faust reports on a collaboration in Milwaukee that aims to help more girls see themselves in the sciences.
A group of fourth and fifth grade girls get robots and a laptop. Their goal is to explore what a robot can do and then execute a routine for it to perform. In the Milwaukee School of Engineering STEM Center, the Girl Scouts of Wisconsin Southeast play around with the sound effects they could code into their robots. Across the table, 10-year-old Vi Michaels is focused. She's wearing her green Girl Scout vest, which is decorated with the badges she's earned. Her brown curly hair frames her face. She's named her robot Popo. She's planned out three moves for it to do. After some tinkering, it can move forward and turn in circles. But when it's supposed to meow like a cat, nothing happens. She turns to the laptop and the code is gone.
Something happened to our code and it like changed.
Even though Popo didn't quite behave the way she wanted, Vi says she still had a lot of fun.
We had a lot of other stuff in it that didn't work. It's fine. Popo was amazing.
Liz Taylor's the director of STEM at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. She says girls and boys of the same age tend to have the same ability at science, technology, engineering, and math, But girls don't always see it.
But their confidence and like self-visualization of their success in those areas tends to differ greatly with young girls, especially feeling like maybe they're not capable of those topics.
She says exposure to STEM early and often can make a difference. A Microsoft study found that girls who do STEM outside of school are more likely to stick with it. But according to the Society of Women Engineers, only 29% of the STEM workforce are women. Barriers include gender stereotypes and male-dominated culture. Jordan Sievert is a biomedical engineering major and volunteered at the event. As a woman in her field, she sometimes feels underestimated.
People don't necessarily expect me to get a full grasp on every challenge thrown my way, but that makes it even more exciting to prove that I can do this just as well and sometimes better than everybody else.
She doesn't want these Girl Scouts to face the same adversity.
I want them to feel empowered and just tackle every challenge head on and that get that confidence that they deserve to have.
Fellow Girl Scout Embry DeGratz faced some challenges while coding her robot. Like Vi, her robot speakers weren't working, and she couldn't get it to make a sound. But she says she isn't discouraged.
You come across lots of problems in your life, but for me, I always try and get back up from it. If I can't, that's a sign to me that this is too hard. Let's try again when I'm a little bit better at it.
It took Vi time to build up her skills. She has advice for younger girls to get started.
Before getting into the big stuff, focus on the smaller stuff that is already made for you that you can work on yourself.
When a visitor at the event asked if they wanted to give robotics another try, the Girl Scouts had a unanimous response.
Yes.
Vi and her troop mates earned a programming robot badge for their work. Now it can be ironed on to their green Girl Scout vests. Margaret Faust, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and all the stories from our WPR News Department, as well as browse our program archives at WPR.org. Stay tuned, there's more to come. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Recent economic reports from the New York Fed and the International Monetary Fund show that Americans are spending more over the last year. According to the latest numbers, consumer spending is up in the U.S., while savings built during the pandemic are down. And that's a unique trend among high-income countries. It may sound a bit puzzling, given ongoing inflation, high interest rates, and the return of student loan payments. So what does high consumer spending mean for the broader economy? And will we keep it up, or is the trend bound to go back down? Our next guest is here to help us figure it out, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do these broader consumer trends reflect what's going on in your own budget? Have you gone back to making more purchases after the pandemic? How do you feel about your household finances right now? And how do you react when you see news about good economic indicators? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Menzi, good to have you back on Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
When we hear consumer spending, that might sound intuitive. Can you give us a bit of a breakdown of what is actually included in that, what's not included in that?
Well, consumer spending is, by definition, the spending that's undertaken by households and nonprofit organizations. And so it's going to include in its entirety, both goods. So if you buy a car, that's going to be in there. If you have get a haircut, that's going to be in there. All those things are going to be included. What won't be in there are, for instance, if a bridge was built by the government, or if a firm bought a machine tool, those won't be in there. But consumer spending is roughly 70% of the economy, the U.S. economy. So, what happens with consumer spending is determinative for what's happening with GDP and overall economic activity.
70% of the U.S. economy. How does that compare to other countries? Do we know?
Well, it's a little bit higher. You know, Americans are known for being more likely to consume than others. But it's been true that, you know, over all sorts of advanced economies, consumption has been rising over time as a share of output. So we're at the high end for sure.
So here we are at this time with high interest rates, ongoing inflation. Why do you think we're seeing high consumer spending right now?
I think there's a multiplicity of reasons why we as economists, for instance, are surprised at how resilient the consumer is. You know, one thing is that we were sort of looking backwards in time and relying upon data that wasn't completely accurate. And so if you'd asked me a month and a half ago, you know, all the packages of support that had been provided during the Trump period when we had the pandemic and including the American Rescue Plan under Biden. And I said, well, you know, all these funds were given to households to support their spending and their ability to survive. When would that be used up? Well, you know, that relies upon a judgment about, you know, how much do people want to save usually. And of course, we know we have lived in atypical times. I think what's true is the economy and how much income we got was turned out to be higher in the most recent estimates that are sort of comprehensive revisions of the data. So much higher than what we had earlier thought, plus what we think people are, how what the rate at which they are saving is less than we would have guessed. And you know why that's the case? Well, it's hard to measure a $28 trillion economy and figure out how much everybody is getting. And you know, people are unpredictable in certain times. And one of the things is people don't seem to be saving as much as they used to in terms of percentage terms, partly because they say, well, my likelihood of getting a job or losing my job is very low. The likelihood of getting a new job is pretty high. And my wage growth is fairly high relative to what it used to be. And so I don't need to save as much for that rainy day as I would have, let's say, pre-pandemic. And so we have the confluence of these two events upping sort of like excess savings that we have as consumers able to tap. And so you might have said, well, maybe we had excess savings of $300 billion and roughly about to run out right about now. Latest estimates have maybe quadrupled that number just because we've got more information.
Sure. So we've seen strong numbers in the labor market recently. What about what people are bringing in the door, though? How are wages looking right now?
Well, wages now are rising faster than the rate of inflation. Now, one has to be careful. You know, there are several ways of measuring the average. One is to say, well, look at all the people who are employed, look at how much in total they've been paid, and just divide one by the other. So that's the average that we typically look at, and that's, you know, exceeding the rate of inflation. If you look, on the other hand, at the household in the middle of the income distribution, you know, so 50% of the households are, or 50% of the wages are lower and 50% of the wages are higher. So look at the median wage and look at how that's compared to inflation. Well, you're a little bit above the rate of inflation over the past year, not as much as the first comparison I would have made. So, you know, in these times where, you know, it's hard to put your finger on the average person, you have to be a little bit cautious about how you tabulate and say, how are we doing? But I would say right now, over the past year, wages are rising faster than inflation.
We're talking with Menzi Chin right now, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at new data that show consumer spending is up in the U.S., and it's staying up for the moment. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Your comments, your questions, how are your household finances looking right now? Are you spending more? 800-642-1234. Menzi, we have been seeing inflation go up, consumer prices go up. Do you think this increased spending is related to making up that difference, or does it go above and beyond that?
Well, I think it's going above and beyond that. And so when I've talked about consumption numbers growing, that's That's after adjusting for inflation. So, you know, what is true was when the government provided these supports in the original CARES Act in March of 2020, the end of 2020, there was a consumer support through COVID package, and then the American Rescue Plan. I mean, all of those things provided extra support either through tax cuts or checks or extended unemployment benefits and so forth to individuals. And, you know, the thing was, for a good amount of time, we couldn't spend it easily because, well, you know, either the restaurants were closed or you didn't want to go out to a restaurant. Whatever reasons, there was a little bit of enforced saving. And some of the spending got dumped onto, you know, buying goods from, you know, a lot of it from overseas, but not all of it. And so, you know, we have built up a war chest that people could spend. And that's what's propelled the economy. And the fact is, with these more recent numbers, we've seen a reassessment of how many resources people had to deploy. And that explains in part why the consumer has surprised the economists in terms of being so resilient and in terms of spending. I would say, you know, they're making their best judgments about, you know, how much they need to save, given their assessment of how well the economy is doing. And so it's in contrast, I'd say, to, let's say, many of the European economies where labor market isn't as vibrant and they've got their own challenges, which make people want to save more for that possible rainy day.
And so often it seems that when a certain economic indicator that comes out, it triggers a reaction in another part of the economy. Mm-hmm. When it comes to consumer spending, what is that most closely linked to in the economy?
Well, I think the way to think about it is there's a certain irony in how resilient the consumer is. So if you look at the first half of this year, as best our statistics tell us, about three quarters of the growth that we've seen is accounted for by consumption. And it's, you know, pretty fast growth in GDP, all things considered. Well, the irony is the faster GDP is growth, holding everything else constant, and at the same time, the more persistent inflation is, the more likely it is that the Fed is going to keep interest rates higher for longer. And that means that eventually the slowdown will hit. And, you know, because all these levers are sort of loosely tied to the things that you want to affect, we run the risk of, well, it looks really good now. The Fed keeps on like pressing on the brakes by letting the interest rate rise or stay high until such time as suddenly things snap and maybe you go into a recession. And the issue is that we don't usually know when we've gone into a recession until we're well into it because our statistics lag so far behind.
We're talking with Menzie Chin, professor of economics and public affairs at UW-Madison, and we are looking at recent reports showing that consumer spending is up while household savings are down in the last year and what it means for the economy. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the economy is headed in a good direction? And what does that look like to you? What factors really are impactful in your everyday life? And what questions do you have about consumer spending and the broader economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with UW-Madison economist Menzie Chin about new reports showing high consumer spending. We're taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling about the economy right now? What makes you feel good or bad about the economy? Let us know at 800-642-1234. And Menzie, despite a lot of positive indicators, it doesn't change the fact that consumer confidence, public opinion polling isn't always that positive about the state of the economy. People aren't always feeling optimistic despite some of the data out there. What do you make of that seeming disconnect?
Yeah, it is kind of a mystery. I mean, some people are speculating that it is just the contrast with recent times where, let's say pre-pandemic, you didn't have all this uncertainty and the prices, the level of prices of things was a lot lower. What's true is now, even as we sit here in 2023 and unemployment is remarkably low, the price of, you know, a gallon of gas or a price of an actual, you know, good or price of a house, lots of things are more expensive. So the rate of inflation has come down substantially from near 10%, 9% earlier in the year to something like closer to 3.7%. That's the rate of change. And for a lot of people, you go into a store and you say, well, a gallon of milk used to be so much lower than it is now. And I think after a period of some 10, 15 years where prices didn't move up a lot, you have this big jump. Maybe that's the reason people still feel uncomfortable or unhappy. The other thing I'll say, and one I can quantify more clearly, is that there's an increasing polarization or partisan aspect to these indicators of sentiment. You know, you ask a bunch of people, how do they feel? And interestingly enough, a lot of it's not related to the statistics we see, like unemployment and inflation. You would think the person who identifies as a Republican or Democrat would, on average, have the same view, just given the same conditions. But what's interesting is when the person of the opposite party occupies the White House, there is this big switch. And, you know, you can just see, even if economic conditions don't change objectively, the viewpoint of how the economy is doing can switch for that individual or that group of individuals. Now, that's been true for 20 years, this sort of partisan divide, but it's grown in size and magnitude, especially over the past 7-8 years. And so part of the explanation for why we see this disjuncture is just the partisan lack of agreement on just the state of the economy.
And you mentioned some of those really visible costs, the milk, the car, the mm-hmm. house. With housing in particular and some of those really big purchases that people want to make, is there a feeling out there that folks are stuck right now because of those high interest rates?
Yeah, I think high interest rates is, once again, a thing that it has both a psychological effect. You haven't seen these things in a long time. And a real effect. And I'll just say, you know, yesterday, I believe it was, we broke 5% on a 10-year Treasury bill. Haven't seen anything like that since 2007 in this country. So what have we done? We've come back to fairly high interest rates in that respect versus a naturally low interest rates. So there's this sharp contrast. Not only are these interest rates back up to levels that we haven't seen in a long time, they have moved extremely fast from unnaturally, in some senses, or rarely seen very low rates. So I think those things have certainly squeezed people. So prices are high, even if inflation has come down, are high, and that's squeezing people out, and certainly squeezing people out of easily buying a new house. And so while we can see that there are a lot of reasons for objectively people to feel good about their situation, you can see, you know, a set of reasons that why they might not. I still say that it is a little bit odd to see this wide of a gap between the objective indicators and the sentiment that we see from the various surveys. And so I still think there's somewhat of a mystery to all this.
Talking with Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, about new data showing strong consumer spending numbers in the economy. We're also taking your calls. Let's go to the phones now. We have David with us in Hampshire, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
My question is I've been listening to NPR for quite a while about the increase in interest rates and how they're not going down. But I'm just a little confused if that's a positive thing, because as a young couple starting out trying to find a home, I mean, we're seeing interest rates up in the 8%, 9%. And I was speaking with somebody I worked with previously that some property values and their percentages are going up to like the 14%. And I'm just wondering, is this a positive thing for our economy to have such high interest rates, or is it better if it does eventually crash and come down?
David, thanks for the call. Menzie, what do you think?
Well, I mean, whether it's good or bad depends in part upon where you stand. So the high interest rates are a benefit to whom? Those who are net savers. Who are net savers? People who built up assets over time. So older people in general, not always, but in general, people who've got assets, now they can get a return on their money that they couldn't get particularly easily in the past. On the other hand, if you're a net borrower, like lots of young people who want to buy a house, you're going to have to borrow typically. And for you, that's gonna cut against you. And so, yes, there are winners and losers to the high interest rates. Now, you might ask, why is the Fed pushing interest rates up? Well, the reason is partly because the Fed has a duty to maintain price stability. And one way you can maintain price stability, that is to keep inflation in check, is to make sure the economy doesn't get too hot. So what we experienced in 2022 and part of 2023 was rapid inflation, made lots of people unhappy because it eroded their purchasing power. Partly that the inflationary pressures was because of our attempt to support the economy, with transfers and extended unemployment benefits and so forth. But you don't want the good time to get too good in terms of prices rising rapidly. And so the Fed's trying to cool things down. And if it can do it without throwing the economy into recession, then that's a good thing. The problem is, of course, there's some pain, but the pain comes because it's trying to deter people from, let's say, buying that additional house or companies from building that new factory might just push things over the edge in terms of having too much activity or buying too many pieces of equipment and so forth. So good or bad, it's hard to say because it depends where you're coming from, but there is a reason why the Fed is pushing interest rates up.
And Menzie, people have been seeing headlines, coverage for well over a year about the potential for a recession. It's always this thing that seems to be looming out there. And it can be easy to lose sight of what that actually means. There is a definition, right? Can you remind us what we're talking about when we hear that recession word in the news?
Well, the people who coined the term recession is a think tank called the National Bureau of Economic Research. And they actually get to define it because they thought of the name. And it's a broad contraction or reduction in economic activity that's somewhat sustained. So it's not like one sector of the economy going down. And it's not necessarily GDP going down, although it might. But it's like the economy broadly contracting over some period of time. And so what's true is, going back to the beginning of our segment, most economists thought that by now we would have had the consumer be tapped out. The monies that had been devoted to in the various packages to support consumers and households would have been spent down. We now discover that, well, people, had more funds and being paid and benefits from the government and transfers from the government and tax reductions than we originally thought. And so the spending went on longer and it's pushed back and back and back when we thought the recession would be. I personally thought it would be, by the end of this year or the beginning of next year. If I look at the average response of a Wall Street economist, they've essentially, on average, they're saying no downturn in GDP growth. And in fact, as little as 3 months ago, Wall Street economists were saying maybe get a percentage point of growth at the end of 2023. Now they're saying like north of 2% growth by the end of this year. We're still, for some of us, still predicting a recession. And the reason why it can occur is because, ironically, once again, the economy has exhibited so much strength, and to less extent, inflation is proven to be a little bit more persistent than we thought, that the Fed will keep interest rates high and maybe it won't calibrate it just right to know when to relent, and that we keep it too high too long so that we go into a recession. So you can see some like bank, you know, credit card bankruptcy rates are rising. So certain other indicators of stress are going to show up for small firms and so forth. And so then the question is, you know, does the Fed overdo it? And
thanks to our guest, Menzie Chin, professor of economics and public affairs at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about the latest trends in consumer spending and what it means for the broader economy. A world-breaking sound was recorded last week in Huntington, England. Roll the tape. That's the sound of Bella the cat setting a new mark for the loudest purring sound ever recorded from a house cat. Bella is 14 years old and reached a decibel level of 54.6. That's about the level of a pot of boiling water. Congrats to Bella. We wish her all the best. The loudest animal in the world, though? Well, that's the sperm whale, with a sound at 233 decibels. Another loud animal I learned about was the tiger pistol shrimp. Apparently, they snap their claws to scare away predators, and the sound can reach 210 decibels, louder than a pistol firing. Not many of us are going to encounter those sounds in the wild, though. We'll stick with our house pets, no matter how loud they might be. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Between 2010 and 2020, more people participated in protests than in any other decade. But despite those movements, our next guest says many protesters didn't see the lasting change they were after. We're learning what sparked those protests in places like Brazil, Egypt, South Korea, and elsewhere, and why so few were successful, with an author who spent time with demonstrators around the world. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in activism or public protests of some kind? What was the experience like? Do you feel like your demonstration or movement got results? And what do you think makes for a protest movement that actually achieves its goals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Vincent Bevins is an award-winning international journalist and correspondent for publications including The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Financial Times. He's the author of the new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Vincent, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think, Vincent, for a lot of us, hearing the 2010s called the mass protest decade might be a little surprising, especially for us here in America. Our minds might go right to the 1960s and 70s. Can you put it in perspective for us and just remind us how widespread protests were during that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the 1960s is the natural reference point, but everything that we know indicates that around the world from 2010 to 2020, more people did take part in protests than even that very famous cycle of contention back in the 60s. It starts really in Tunisia and then Egypt with what becomes called the Arab Spring, dubbed the Arab Spring by foreign media, and this does start to matter. And then in 2013, you get uprisings in Turkey, Brazil, Ukraine. You move on, you get Hong Kong, you get South Korea, you get Chile, you get Hong Kong again. And I think that what happens in 2020 after the death of George Floyd should be considered part of this broad, broad process of contagion and learning that spreads throughout the world in the 2010s. But it's really when we take a global look at protests that it becomes clear that so much of history in this decade was powered by mass protests and as what I point to as their often unintended consequences.
And this question might not have a good answer because I know every movement has its own goals and its own circumstances, but can we say why we saw so many protests during that 10-year period?
Oh, well, so I think that there must always be multiple causality to get a protest to be very, very big. There must always be more than one thing that is behind people deciding to risk their lives or at least risk their safety to go to the streets. I think that one part of what happens in the 2010s is the long consequences of the 2008 financial crisis. So many movements around the world were responding in some way to the fallout of the apparent failures of the global capitalist system that had been promised as such a great thing in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union. I think social media is a part of the story, but again, I think it's only a part of one of the, it's only one of the things that gets you over the line to having a really a mass protest. I don't think it's often what these things are really about. And then, yeah, as you point, you really have to look at national conditions. Sometimes you have an authoritarian government. Sometimes you have horrifying police brutality. Now, police brutality very, very often is the trigger, even if there are many other reasons that people pour into the streets. So one thing that I hope that becomes clear from this book and this investigation is, while certain trends are global, national particularities matter quite a bit. And I think one thing that did happen in this, in what I call the mass protest decade, is a tendency to see things as if they're all the same, a tendency to perhaps copy and paste a tactic that seemed to work elsewhere into a very different condition, or a media viewing, major media actors viewing an uprising in one country as if it's the same as another without really understanding the differences between those countries. So it's an attempt at a complex answer to a good but difficult question.
And you write that a lot of these movements had a similarity in the way they were structured, organized. You say they were often spontaneous and often horizontally structured. What do we mean by that?
So horizontalism was something that was adopted by certain groups as an intentional way of organizing protests. But sometimes you also just saw that things were horizontally structured. And what that means basically is leaderlessness, a situation in which no one can really claim to speak for everybody that is in the square or in the streets. No one that is able to represent the people on the ground, everyone perhaps coming for their own reasons and everyone having their own rights to push for a particular direction. And this was something that came out of certain ideological tendencies in the 90s. The anti-globalization movement was very horizontal, but also it came out of certain countries where, like Egypt, even if the revolutionaries there would have loved to have more structured, hierarchical, and dedicated organizations, there just weren't any left after decades of decimation under authoritarian government. So you saw apparent spontaneity, usually meaning that things come together very, very quickly. And this is not something that happens only because of social media, but social media makes it easier for things to come together more quickly. And when I say horizontal, I mean that there's no one leading it. There's no one to say with authority what this is really about. And there's no one, and this becomes crucial later, to step into a power vacuum if one is created, or to articulate what the streets would accept as a victory.
And we are talking with Vincent Bevins, author of the new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. And Vincent, in most of the examples you look at in your book, you say that they ultimately weren't successful in getting that lasting change. I want to zoom in on one of those right now, in one of the largest democracies in the world, a place you worked for a long time, Brazil. Let's go back to 2013 and the Free Fair Movement. What was happening there? What were the demands being put forth?
Absolutely. And I think back in the 60s, in other parts of history, it would be quite normal to see protests that get nothing done, that are simply ignored. But we often saw this actually a strange reversal, even if you listen to, especially if you listen to what the original organizers of the protest said that they wanted, they often got the exact opposite. And Brazil is an iconic case of this. And it's one that, as you mentioned, matters dearly to me because I lived through all of it. So the Free Fair Movement was a group of leftists and anarchists that were trying to advocate for lower public transportation. Indeed, they wanted public transportation to be free for all Brazilians at all times. And they organized a set of protests starting in June 2013. Now, what happens is that the media call for a crackdown on the protests. The crackdown comes, but the crackdown is so shocking that the country, but especially the mainstream media itself, flip their message and say, actually, this is a great thing. In the morning, they were saying these are punks and anarchists that need to be cleared off the streets after they see this horrible episode of police brutality. The narrative shifts to this is a great thing. This is a uprising in defense, not of this specific transportation cause, but in defense of the right to protest in general. And millions of people flood into the streets. And they all flood the streets for their own reasons, often understanding what the protests are as a result of how they consumed media representation of the protests. And in the short term, you actually get a conflict between the new arrivals and the original organizers, which ultimately ends in the expulsion of the original leftists and radicals that had organized the protests by new arrivals that tended to be more right-wing. And in the long term, as this huge ball of energy that nobody really knew how to deal with sort of grows and grows, because even though people are starting to talk about Brazil as if it is a Brazilian version of the Arab Spring, a Brazilian Spring, a kind of Tahrir moment, Brazil has a democracy and quite a popular social democratic president. So as this ball of energy grows and no one really knows what to do with it, including the original organizers, including the president, including the mayor of Sao Paulo, who's in charge of lowering the bus fares, a new set of actors sort of emerge from this pressure cooker with a very different set of goals. The free fare movement, as you say, the MPL, finds itself replaced ultimately by another group of more free market and libertarian youngsters, young activists with links to the United States. And they intentionally start a group that is meant to trick people. They start a group which is the Free Brazil Movement, but the acronym ends up being MBL. And in this strange cauldron pressure cooker of energy unleashed, many, many groups are born, which ultimately push the country to the right, help to remove elected President Dilma Rousseff, help to elect far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, and really ultimately, I think, give Brazilians the opposite of what it seemed they were asking for when they first poured into the streets in defense of better public services.
So what was the factor, do you think, that was missing there? And I know you talked to many, many people, you saw it firsthand. What was this, the missing factor? Was it organization or something else?
Well, in this particular case, and as you point out, I did this book doing something like 225 interviews over 4 years in 12 countries. And so I really asked everybody on all sides of this conflict in Brazil, what could have gone differently? What went wrong? And the answers were often contradictory. But a certain set of conundrums, I would say, arise as really important. On the one hand, this free fare movement believed, like I think a lot of us really always believed, especially in my generation at the beginning of the decade, that if you just got everyone out on the streets behind you, then that would be good. How could that not be good? But it turns out behind is not the same as after. The fact that they come next doesn't necessarily mean that they're behind. They come with their own ideas. And if there's no structure in place to sort of decide what the thing is about, it just becomes a game of counting opinions. And if the new opinions are more right-leaning, then the right-leaning people win control of the streets and they're able to effectively expel the originals. So there's the idea that the street explosion would always go your way turned out not to be true. And then there was the very particularly horizontalist formation of this group in Brazil. They believed they were against leaders. They were against any type of delegation of roles even within the organization. So when it came time for them to deal with this unexpected explosion, they had to have 14-hour, 16-hour meetings so that they could get every single person in the group to agree, because they believed in the full consensus model of organizing. This is something that we saw in Occupy Wall Street in 2011. This is maybe familiar to some people in the U.S. And when they said, well, no, we don't want to lead anything, other more savvy people, other people that did not have these sort of idealist approaches to political change, just said, okay, we'll step into the vacuum and we will use our very well-funded and very hierarchically organized organizations to push this whole thing to the right, because there's energy on the streets and we're going to take advantage of it. Now, whether or not it was possible to take advantage of this strange explosion at all, that's hard to say, but it is absolutely true that the right are the groups that win the battle to redefine what this is all about. And they use their sort of, you know, one of the kids had been trained by the Koch brothers in the United States. Other kids in this at the beginning of a far right movement had been funded by groups in the U.S. They knew what they wanted to get done, and they were very, very sort of unashamed and merciless about pushing towards the right. And everybody else was left trying to figure out what happened.
We're talking with journalist and author Vincent Bevins about his new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Still time for you to join in at 642-1234. What do you think makes for an effective protest movement? Have you been part of one yourself? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter in today for Rob Ferret. That's the sound of protesters chanting in the Wisconsin State Capitol in 2011 in opposition to the Anti-Union Legislation Act 10, one of the many protests of the last decade. We're taking a global look at protest in the 2010s right now with Vincent Bevins. His new book is If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones now. We have Jody with us in Downing. Hi, Jody.
Hi. I actually got on the show a little late, so I don't know if you've already covered this, but I'm looking for some hope here and hoping that the author has some ideas of what has worked or what does work. Because being in Wisconsin and watching what happened at the Capitol that you just played is really disheartening. So I'll hang up and listen.
Jody, thanks for the call. We haven't covered that yet, but I wanted to. Vincent, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't get cover this. I'm grateful to Jody for pushing me in this direction. These 250, 225 interviews that I did, these people that I spoke with around the world, they would not have sat down with me. They would not have gone through these very difficult experiences. They would have not been part of this project to create a book out of this decade if they did not believe in learning from what had happened and coming back to fight better another day. There is, I think, a clear desire across the planet to change our particular global system. And so if, as I think emerges out of this book, the problem is really one of tactics, of a mismatch between tactics and goals, then what is an apparently pessimistic story becomes quite an optimistic one. Because if it's really just a mismatch between tactics and goals, well, that's not so hard to do. You've got the energy, you've got the people, you've got the people willing to take risks and take action. You just need to change the recipe slightly. And the answers to how to change the recipe vary, as you would expect, over a couple hundred interviews. But some things rise to the top as being, shared by many of the interviewees. And one is that the better organized you are going into the unexpected explosion, the better you're going to do inside of it. It's very difficult to put together a real movement, a real organization, which is capable of acting collectively in the heat of the moment. So one lesson that often emerges from these conversations is to build in the off season, build bonds with other human beings, when it seems like nothing is happening, because they can be useful in ways which you could not imagine. And then again, in this book, not everything is a failure, right? So there are cases where things do move forward in slightly unexpected ways. But in Chile, you get a president from the protest generation of 2011. And this is the same, I think. I think that the Wisconsin protests, although I don't know the content so well myself, I think that they really do fit into this sort of post-Tahrir Square Egyptian inspired group of protests. If I'm not mistaken, someone in Egypt like sent pizza to Wisconsin. This transfer of solidarity across countries is really great. The version of this that takes place in Chile eventually wins power, and it takes years. What is an apparent failure becomes an ultimate victory, because they don't give up, they reorganize, they enter institutional power. Some of them stay on the streets. So I do hope that the book, it's hard to summarize everything now, but I do hope that it looks forward as well as backwards.
And it sounds like one of the takeaways, well, you ask people, what is your advice for future generations of activists, whatever their causes may be? And it sounds like people were content with the fact that that they were happy with the fact that they have shown there's energy that's possible, like pre-visioned a better future and a better system. Is that fair to say?
I think that what a lot of people told me is that they hope to live in a future in 10 years in which, looking back on what I call the mass protest decade, they see the seeds of an ultimate victory. They see that the first, you know, first kicks and starts demonstrated a real desire for improvements to the global system. It didn't work perfectly the first time around, but that you can come back, take that energy, learn from it, and rebuild with a better understanding of the stakes and the way things go after the initial apparent success. Because one of the things that happens over and over in this book, and because it happens in the decade, is that mass protests, not accidentally, but unexpectedly, put far, far more people on the streets than they had imagined were possible. The original organizers are overwhelmed by just how many people can come together for the broad goal of changing the world for the better. And then that generated opportunities. And we just talked briefly about the Brazilian context, but across the decade, that generated opportunities that people hadn't really thought about. But now we can see how this goes. We can see what kinds of things that may be worth preparing for, thinking about if you are organizing mass movements. And so a lot of people came back and said, yeah, now we know what happens. And we hope that when it happens again, enough people that believe that, you know, that think like me, that are ideally working with me hand in hand, will have learned from the first round and can come back better.
And what do you think will happen in this decade in terms of protests, in terms of movements aligning those tactics with their goals? Do you think we'll see a change?
I don't know.
It's a big one, I know.
I think that whatever is going to happen, and it sounds like I'm evading the question, but I also do believe in this answer. Whatever is going to happen, whatever is going to come our way, whether or not it's a new war in the Middle East, whether or not it's climate catastrophe, whether or not it's the breakdown of the governance of the United States, Washington, D.C., the more we carefully study recent history, the more we carefully study what's the actual conditions of things around us, the better equipped we're going to be to respond to what comes.
And as we wrap up, Vincent, what are you hoping people take away from your book? If they're, especially from an American context, and they may not be as familiar with these international movements, what do you think they really take away? What do you hope resonates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that each reader will come to this book with a different set of experiences. And I think Wisconsin readers will view it in terms of what they've lived through. I've been gratified. I just did a tour of the U.S. A lot of people told me that the book reflected their experiences. I think that people, you know, in Iran will view the book reflected through their experiences. But if I had to come up with, you know, a quick summary of an optimistic and forward-looking lesson that I found touching in the book, because I'm trying to avoid giving any of my own, but one of the lessons that I found touching that came out of the interviews at the end is like, look, an imperfect world is here. We're going to be alive. There's no better way to spend this life than finding other people that want to improve the world, improve life for other human beings, and working hand in hand with them to build a better future. It may not work right away. It may not work for a long time. But if you know that you're doing your best to create the best world that you can, and you're doing it hand in hand with other people, there's no better way to spend your life.
Well, Vincent, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Vincent Bevins, author of the new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of us rely on Google to search the internet, but a lot of people are noticing the results just aren't as good as they used to be. We'll find out why as the company's grown to control more of the internet. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a new NASA mission is sending a probe to orbit a metallic asteroid in the middle of our solar system. We'll talk with a space expert about what we hope to learn about the insides of planets. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.